But what we're going to talk about today is this framework, this concept of history and memory in the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in our experience at the Seder and at Pesach overall. And I want to look at it through an interesting lens of someone named Joseph Campbell, but we're not going to get there quite yet. First, we're going to look at insights from Rabbi Sacks. We're going to have some inspiration from Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Dr. Lam Zichron Livracha, and I'm very excited about this year. I'm very excited and looking forward to learning together. So to start out, for those who are so brave enough, I invite you to close your eyes. And even if you're not going to close your eyes, we can imagine standing at a cliff. And maybe you're at the top of Masada, maybe you're on a hike on Chol HaMoed, but you're standing at a cliff, and just look over the cliff and look down. And I'm wondering if anyone else is feeling some feelings of anxiety near their stomach rumbling. And I had such an experience. This happened to me many times. Baruch Hashem, I have many talents, but I definitively define myself as someone afraid of heights. My second summer running a TJJ bus, running a summer trip for public school students through NCSY. It was like the third day of the trip. And we go on a hike, and the hike's going well. And then I see that there's a little pool. Okay, the pool's fine, but next to the pool, there's about a 15-foot cliff. And all of my campers, all of the NCSYers, are climbing up the top of this cliff and jumping off. And as they're jumping off, they notice me standing there, and they're like, "All right, you gotta come check this out." And at first, I was playing I'm going to be the adult watching, make sure everyone's okay. But eventually, that didn't work, and my staff members, my co-director, everyone was convincing me that I had to jump off the cliff. And I remember standing on that cliff and thinking, this is so silly. I've watched so many people jump off of this, been totally safe, totally fine. Why can't I jump off the cliff? But I was petrified. I could not do it. Eventually, I mustered up the courage. I jumped off. Sure enough, I was perfectly safe. But when we're confronted with a cliff, when we're standing at the edge of a cliff, what are we so nervous about? Why was I so nervous on that hike in Israel? What about a cliff invokes that anxiety, that trepidation almost? Dr. Jordan Peterson, who was an acclaimed author and now is involved in a lot of other things, but back in the day, he has a lot of fantastic psychology lectures because ultimately he's a clinical psychologist and professor. And he talks about how there is a philosopher / psychologist who explains what's going on when we're looking at a cliff. Because in reality, a cliff is a collection of rocks. And that collection of rocks might be standing 2 feet high, it might be standing 10 feet high, 15 feet high, or 100 feet high. But it's just a collection of rocks. And if I'm standing at the front of the cliff, or if I'm standing at the edge of the cliff, my level of safety hasn't really changed. If I'm standing at the cliff 10 feet away from the edge, or 1 foot away from the edge, the likelihood of me falling is not really increased at all. And yet, the closer and closer I get to that edge, the more and more nervous I become. Why? Because when we look at a cliff, we're not really seeing a cliff. We're not really seeing a collection of rocks. What are we seeing? We're seeing how it relates to me, how that it impacts me. And what I'm seeing relative to me is not that collection of rocks sitting there doing nothing, but that collection of rocks that really, for me, is not a cliff, but a possibility of falling. I look at that and say, I could fall off of that. That could be dangerous. That could be very scary. And I get nervous. Even though standing a foot away from the edge of the cliff, I'm not going to fall. I'm not likely to fall. There's no reason to think that I'll fall. But in my mind, what we associate is this is a falling opportunity. This is dangerous. And we get nervous. And so what this framework of looking at a cliff and getting nervous, I think is helpful for everything we're going to talk about this evening, because when this approach of an appreciation of a cliff is really how we look at so many things in our lives. All the objects are relative to how it interacts with me, that not in a self-absorbed way, but we interact with the world relative to ourselves. We understand the world relative to ourselves. And so if that's the case when it comes to objects in the world and experiences that we have, it also would apply to our Jewish experiences, to our religious experiences, to the experience of the Leil HaSeder. And that really is how Rabbi Sacks frames the conversation about Leil HaSeder. In his Haggadah, beautiful, beautiful Haggadah, I highly recommend it, from Koren, he talks about the difference between history and memory. And we're going to elaborate on the differences between history and memory more as we go. But effectively, he tells us that history, from the word, is his story. It's separate from me. It's something that happened to someone else. But memory is something that happened to me. Memory is something that's relevant to me. Maybe we'll just elaborate a little bit before we jump in. The language of zikhira, which is how we say memory, zikhira and zakhar, have the same root. They're effectively the same word. Zikhira, meaning memory, and zakhar, meaning male, are closely related because whenever we have the language of zakhar, implying the opposite of nekeva, the opposite of female, male and female, from a Kabbalistic perspective, for sure, but we don't even have to go that far, we can just look at it physically. Zakhar is always giving, and female is always receiving, and so if the language for memory, for remembering something, is zikhira, the language of zakhar, it means that it must be contributing something to me. Rabbi Sacks doesn't say that. That's a little bit of, I guess, my own addition. But if zikhira is supposed to contribute, it's supposed to give something, then what is the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim that we're going to talk about in less than 1 week? How is that contributing to me? What does that mean for me? And now I want to introduce you to Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell passed away about 50 years ago. He is an acclaimed author, and arguably his most famous book is called The Hero of 1,000 Faces. Now, The Hero of 1,000 Faces, it's a monumental work. Joseph Campbell spent his whole life obsessed with myth, with heroes, with villains, with the stories that we tell. And not just in our culture, not just in Western cultures, but in cultures abound. He read everything. The term hero of 1,000 faces is not hyperbole. He literally read over 1,000 stories. He quotes, and he's familiar with anything and everything. Any hero conversation he's discussed, he's explored. And what he points out in that story is something a little bit surprising. And I truth be told, I was first exposed to this through a comedian. The comedian was joking, as is his job, that the storyline of Harry Potter and the storyline of Star Wars are very similar. So if we can entertain a more modern culture and pop culture discussion for a moment, the storyline of both Star Wars and Harry Potter discuss a young orphan boy who's living with his aunt and uncle. He was dropped off by someone mysterious. That same mysterious gentleman's going to come pick him up one day and tell him that that there's a whole world out there that he's never explored, and he has untold powers. He's stronger than anyone else around, and if only he would realize it. Ooh, 1 second. Sorry. Keep it off. Aim takes priority. I had to make sure my mom knew what was happening. And so this young man is now taken from his home onto a journey, and maybe he's given some sort of tool in order to lead him to success, whether it's a wand, whether it's a sword, and he's going to make a friend. He's going to make a friend who's male, who's not necessarily so smart, but he's helpful and he's loyal. He's going to make a female friend who's going to be much, much smarter than both he and his male friend put together, and ultimately he's going to go up against this big, bad evil, this big villain who was involved in the death of his parents, and his ultimate goal will be that showdown. That was a very light, cursory description of both the books and movies Harry Potter and that of Star Wars. But really, I was also describing, in some ways, although not with all the same details, story of Beowulf and the story of the Odyssey and so many mythical stories that have taken place, that have been told and retold so many times over the years. And what Joseph Campbell asserts in his book, The Hero of 1,000 Faces, is that mythical stories are really the same story over and over and over again, but we're always interacting with the same story. It's the same journey, and I highly recommend checking it out. You can look at his book. I think there's actually a Netflix special dedicated to this idea, but even if you just search for the monomyth, The Hero's Journey, he calls it a monomyth, a singular myth, because it's all one story just over and over again with different details. You know, you switch out a lightsaber for a wand, switch out a wand for a ring, and you've got Lord of the Rings, and the list goes on and on and on. But the question then begs itself, if this is the same story, maybe a few different details, but effectively the same story, why would I ever read the Harry Potter books if I've seen the Star Wars movies? Why would I ever interact with any of these if I've read Homer's works of the Iliad or the Odyssey? Why am I interacting with the same story, the same myth, over and over and over again? What about that is exciting? What about that is interesting? Suggests Joseph Campbell that it's not just the same story over again and the familiarity of the story, but we actually appreciate the story because we see ourselves in the story. The hero's journey that's prevalent in so many of these mythological narratives is not just the journey of an external hero, that individual, but it's my story. It's a story of us. And we all see ourselves in this story. And so maybe I'm not fighting up against a fire-breathing dragon, but maybe I am fighting a dragon in some way. And maybe it's not breathing fire, maybe it doesn't have a tail and wings, but maybe it's a boss who actually might be breathing fire in some way. Maybe I'm going up against something that's stopping me from accomplishing my goals, that's stopping me from becoming the person that I want to be. And so when I watch Luke Skywalker, when I watch Harry Potter, when I watch any of these mythological heroes go up against their big bad, I'm seeing myself go up against that big bad as well. The city director, or the NCSY director in St. Louis, Sam Zitton, introduced this to me for the first time over a year ago, and I've been thinking about it, I wouldn't say nonstop, but a lot since, trying to figure out how it relates, and I think it connects very nicely, very beautifully to our conversation tonight about history and memory and the role of the Pesach story, the Pesach Seder. But what Sam takes one step further is, why do we connect so much to that story? Not just because we see ourselves in it, but really, if you look at it, that's a story of Tanakh. It's a story of the Torah. Moshe is one of the most common characters that affiliates with this whole hero's journey. And we can play it out another time how Moshe fits in so perfectly. But what it's really saying is that we like these stories because these stories are just another way of describing the stories we see in the Torah, the stories we see in Tanakh. And what I might even add further is that it's built into our DNA. Because built into our DNA is the way that God created the world. And we know the Zohar tells us that that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the Torah and created the world. He stakel b'araisa u'bara alma, Torah, world. And so if the world is set up this way, if our DNA is set up consistent with the Torah, and the Torah narrative is clearly creating this hero arc, the hero's journey, the monomyth that Joseph Campbell is teaching us about, then really we're just interacting with the Torah. We're interacting with the base DNA of who we are. And so with that framework, with that understanding that the Pesach narrative is not just a narrative about something that happened to us 3,000 years ago, something that happened to us long ago, it happened to my ancestors, but actually something that I can read myself into, that I can appreciate, connects to me, now the Pesach Seder makes a lot more sense. It's much easier. Because I'm sure not the first one, and I don't even feel so heretical in saying that the obligation of Bechol Dor V'Dor in every generation, Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo Kilu Hu Yatzma Mitzrayim, a person is obligated to feel as though he or she left Egypt. I didn't leave Egypt. True, this Passover, I will be able to leave my home. I do not plan on being in this apartment for the Seders like I was last year, and so there's a little bit of a Yitzia happening, but I wasn't in Egypt. I wasn't enslaved. No one has been whipping me in the back. No one has been enslaving me in a harsh labor that I need to be freed from using miracles and the hand of God. But if I can appreciate this story, if I can appreciate the narrative of Yetzias Mitzrayim as not relating specifically necessarily that the finite details apply to me, but the general narrative of being a journey, being a hero's journey that I can see myself in, that this is a journey that I interact with on how it interacts with me, what it means to me, then I still can see myself. I still can say that I'm able to see myself as having left Egypt, because I appreciate that Egypt is metaphorical. Egypt is a meitzar. It's a boundary. And so many of us so often are leaving our boundaries. Quite literally, the example I gave is that I'm leaving the boundaries of this home. I'm leaving the boundaries of Chicago and able to visit my family in New Jersey, in New York. But in so many ways, we're leaving the boundaries that confine us. We're fighting the fire-breathing dragon in one way, shape, or form. And we can extend that a little bit. Rabbi Sachs teaches in his Festival of Freedom, in his book about Pesach, he talks about how in every generation we say literally v'hisha amda lavasein v'lanu, that this is what held us up. This is what enabled us to survive from every generation, because b'chol dor v'dor Om Dom Aleinu L'chal Oseinu. In every generation, they are trying to defeat us, they are trying to stop us. There's always an enemy at play. And all this is doing is illustrating the point we just made, that in every generation, I'm going to face something. I'm going to face a Mitzrayim. I'm going to want to have a Yetzias Mitzrayim, a leaving of Egypt, and And how am I going to experience that? What's that going to look like? And every generation is going to look a little different. But every generation, we know that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to help us. A Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to be part of that process of taking us out of Egypt. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, you can also find this in his Haggadah, but Arami Ovid Avi, introducing that process of talking about how we always have enemies. It's kind of a funny thing. This is, I guess, a Dvar Torah you can share more succinctly at your Seder, that we introduce Arami Ovid Avi with Vihisha Amda. We introduce these phrases, these lines of the drushos of the Passover Seder, of the Haggadah, really the focal point of the Haggadah, the Arami Ovid Avi, that Lavan seemingly tried to hurt us. Lavan tried to stop Yaakov, and therefore Yaakov ended up going down to Egypt. But why do we introduce that with Vihisha Amda? Because in one generation it was Lavan, and Lavan seems anachronistic. What's Lavan doing in a story about Pesach? Well, because Lavan is just an indication, an example of, it's not just that generation, it's not just Yaakov's children's generation that faced persecution. Lavan persecuted Yaakov, and then after Lavan came Paro, and then after Paro comes someone else. And Rabbi Lam, Isaac Levraka, points out that Paro isn't given a name. Paro is a title. Paro means king. Why isn't Paro given a name? One argument is that we would read too much into the personality. But the other element of it is that Paro is just a player. He's a player in this game. He's a player in this process, in our story, in our narrative, in our collective memory. And so whether it's Paro one year, whether it's Lavan someone another year, and whether it's any number of the people who have persecuted us over time, there's always going to be someone, to cite Rabbi Soloveitchik, someone worse, someone who possessed by a psychopathic, cruel, bloodthirsty hate. Only the steady vigilance of the Almighty has saved us from complete annihilation. And so when we go into the Pesach Seder, we're seeing how this story, this narrative, is really, it's about us, it's about me. I'm seeing myself as the hero. And so we don't need to see the details, we don't need to see the specific names. Rav Golvig Zichron Levracha from KBY, the Rosh Hashiva of KBY, who started KBY, he writes that it's not a coincidence that Sefer Shmos opens without any names. The Pesach story opens with no names. We meet an Ishmi based Levi, Vayikakas Bas Levi. We see a man from the house of Levi marrying the daughter of Levi. We meet Shifra and Pua, not their real names. We meet a mysterious boy who will eventually be the savior, but we don't actually know his name. The name Moshe is actually given to him by Bas Paro, not by his own parents. We only know from the Gemara and the Midrashim that his parents named him Tuvia or Avigdor. And so we see all these different disconnects of names. We see all these mysterious names. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says this, many people say this, that the disconnect of names, the lack of names, is not because we didn't get the historical details right, but because this is not a historical narrative. Pesach Seder is not about history. Pesach Seder is about memory. And if it's memory, if it's something that's relevant to me, then it's just the only thing that's important is that it's an Ishmi Beis Levi Vayikakas Bas Levi. It's the son and the daughter of a Jew, of Levi, of Ben Yisrael and Bas Yisrael coming together to save the Jewish people. And so too, when we read the story this year ourselves, it's going to be about us coming together to save the Jewish people. Let's elaborate on Rabbi Sacks for just a moment. Rabbi Sacks, in his discussion about history versus memory, he points out that history is, as we said, is external versus memory is internal. And so if I'm looking at the Pesach Seder and I'm looking at it and appreciating that this is relevant to me, it matters to me, then it's going to have a difference. Because history is something that happened externally. We can talk about history taking place and it doesn't impact, doesn't affect us, doesn't bother us. But when we talk about things that happen to us, when we talk about things that are relevant to us, it can. And so the example that I'll give is admittedly a little bit extreme, but okay. There are a lot of people who study history. And one person could be studying history, one person could be studying memory, but it's the same content. What's the example? We can easily imagine Holocaust studies in a high school, or at any point in time. We can decide that we're going to study a period of history, and maybe we're going to study the period of history of Germany and general Europe from 1939 to 1945. And for some people, that will be a study of history. But that's not really true for those of us who were impacted in some way, shape, or form by the Holocaust, by any Jew who was impacted in some way, shape, or form by the Holocaust. Because just studying that history, it's not a history, it's a memory. It feels like a memory. And the proof for it is that if we were teleported to 1939, to the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. The Brandenburg Gate is one of the locations where Chabad puts up massive Chanukios every year in order to basically show the Germans that that we won, that we weren't wiped out. And so, you know, every year I've seen it for 2015, 2017, 2018, the side by side, you know, a German rally with the Nazi flags in Machshamom, and then the Chabad menorah that's massive and no one could ever possibly light normally, right next to it, showing the contrast. And so, if God forbid, if somehow we were transported to that rally with the Nazi flags, the Yimach Shemam, would that be a historical journey? Would that feel the same as it would maybe to, you know, to be transported to 1776 at the writing of the Declaration of Independence? Is that the same experience? I can say for sure for me, and I think it's safe to say for many of us, being transported to a period of American history, it's history. It's something that happened, but it's external to me. But being transported, God forbid, to Nazi Germany is not history, even though it happened in the past. It's memory. It impacts me. Now, even though I didn't go through the Holocaust, it wasn't something that happened to me. It didn't even happen to any of my direct ancestors. But that's something that's communal memory. That's Jewish memory. And that feeling that I would have would not be an intellectual exploration of something that happened in the past, of a story of the past. But it would make my skin curl. It would make me uncomfortable. Because the memory of the Jewish people is something that sticks with us. It's something that impacts us. And the impact of that memory, in the case of the Nazis, is unfortunately very uncomfortable and very unpleasant. And so when we're looking at the Seder, are we seeing ourselves in the Seder? Are we seeing ourselves in the story? Are we stuck in Mitzrayim? Are we needing to become our own heroes? Are we going to need 10 plagues? Is the Kadosh Baruch Hu going to have to take us out in some miraculous way, shape, or form? Are we going to have to be like B'nai Yisrael, who are able to have faith through the hardship, through the difficulty? That's the story that we're talking about. That's the question, the Leil HaSeder. Are we able to do this? Are we able to conjure it up again and again and again? And the Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about the concept of a ksav and a mechstav. And yeah, this is in his book, the Drashos HaRav, where he talks about, he cites the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, in the fifth parak, the eighth Mishnah, that during the twilight of the sixth day of creation, right before Shabbos, there are a number of things were created. One thing was Miriam's well, and the man was created, and the two lukos that were given at Har Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu's grave, the cave of Eliyahu Navi, the location where Korach and his congregation would end up being swallowed up, and Haksav v'hamichsav, the writing and the ability to write. Now, the common understanding of that, in all fairness, is the ksav, the ketav is just the conventional Hebrew alphabet, and the mikhtav was the special kind of Hebrew alphabet that a Kodesh Baruch Hu used when writing the Luchos. But Rabbi Soloveitchik takes this to another level, and he admits that it's a little bit of a drasha, it's a little bit of an extension of maybe of the straightforward understanding, the pshat, but he says the ksav and the mikhtav is the ability for us to write on ourselves and write on the next generation, to write on someone else. That the ability for us at our Pesach Seders to communicate something that we have no business being able to communicate. Because there's no reason why, in the year 2021, I should care about something that happened in 1941. Something that happened 80 years ago should not be relevant to my life, and yet it is. Because the Jewish people were given the ability to, not just of the ksiva, not just something to write down, but the mikhtav, to have it written upon us, that we were able to communicate something for generation and generation. And that's what's happening the Seder night. As for so many of us, most years, and God willing, this year, if the CDC guidelines allow it, we have starim not just ourselves, but starim with multiple generations. I'm reminded of Rabbi Daniel Mechanic. Rabbi Mechanic is one of the lead Makarvim, one of the first rabbis of Eshet Torah, who was recruited directly by Rav Noach Weinberg. And he talks about how at his Seder, when he was growing up, when he was 7, 8 years old, his great-grandfather grabbed his hand and told him that just the hand that you're holding right now is the same hand that was held by my great-grandfather and his great-grandfather by his grandfather. And effectively, Rabbi Mechanic communicated that it just took 11 Pesach Starim to get from Rabbi Mechanic living in the year 2021 all the way back to Rashi. And part of what's happening with Sora is we're making a connection from our Seder, from one to the next, one generation to the next. What we're doing is we're taking a ksav and a mikhsav, we're writing onto the next generation, writing onto ourselves, if necessary, the connection of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're taking that modality, that framework that Joseph Campbell introduced to us, that I, when I look at a story, I don't just have to see a story about someone else. That story can be about me. That story, that hero's journey, that narrative can be about me. And I just need to figure out how to read myself into that story in order to find that familiarity, to find that relevance to me. And so with the way the Rav talks about it, he addresses that we have so many different menhagim at the Seder, so many things. And maybe I'll elaborate a little bit. It's kind of a funny experience that the Seder night is this night where we're supposed to remember the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're supposed to remember what happened in Egypt. And yet, there's a lot of details. There's a lot of things we're supposed to do. We're supposed to have matzah, and you're supposed to eat matzah in a certain way in a certain amount of time, and the matzah is supposed to be like this and not like that. It's got to be cracked, but not too cracked. You're supposed to have this part here and that part then, and you're supposed to be combined with maror, or with lettuce, and you're supposed to have kairosis, and you're supposed to dip things, and you're supposed to lean. We've got all these details involved, and the goal is just to remember something. The more that I'm engaged in what's happening right now, what's happening in front of me, the more I'm trying to focus on balancing all the things, I'm making sure that I'm leaning the right way and I'm drinking the right amounts, we would imagine that would actually be distracting, that would keep us from doing what we're supposed to be doing, from remembering what happened in the past. So why is there so much ritual? Why are there so many halakhot that pertain to the Seder night? I think I misspoke. Rabbi Lam talks about this. He says, and this is commenting in his Haggadah, the royal table, commenting on the response to in the four children of Ba'avur Zeh, because of this, I was redeemed. This is the response to the wicked son. The wicked son is saying, the wicked child, the wicked child is not necessarily a son. Girls are allowed to be Rishayim also, although I guess more frequently we find it in young men. But the wicked child saying, Mahavoda Zoslachem, what's all this to you? Why do you guys have so much ritual? Why does this have to be such an elaborate process? Why do you need to worry about this? Why are you calculating exactly how much matzah you need to make sure you have a kazayas? Why are you drinking just that amount of wine and not just saying, oh, I'm going to drink wine, it's not a big deal? What we say is, Ba'avur Zeh, because of this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Egypt. And on page 42, Rabbi Lam's Haggadah, he points out that we're mistranslating the Pasuk. That Ba'avur Zeh, Yatzata Hashem HaKenim Mitzrayim, that God took us out of Egypt. We're mistranslating the pasuk, because it doesn't mean that God took us out of Egypt and therefore we eat matzah and maror. Rather, what it says is that God took us out of Egypt in order, for the sole purpose, seemingly, of eating matzah and maror. Why would God take us out of Egypt for the purpose of eating matzah and maror? He says, clearly, it is not halakha that recapitulates history, but history that prepares the way for halakha. Tradition, for the Jew, is not a nostalgic recollection of the past, but the long process of preparing for a spiritually meaningful future by consecrating the present. The rituals that take place at the Seder, says Rabbi Sachs, are not about remembering what happened. By eating X amount of matzah or drinking that amount of wine, it's not about remembering what took place, but it's about experiencing it. It's about living it. It's about taking what happened in the past and making it relevant to here. The way Rabbi Soloveitchik said it, it's about the ksav and the mikhtav, about writing onto ourselves, writing onto the next generation. And Rav Soloveitchik elaborates in this Drashas HaRav Sefer that the goal is to be a sofer. The goal is to be not a storyteller or a writer, but a storyteller. What stories are we telling at the Seder? Are the stories we're telling at the Seder the stories of other people, external stories, or are there stories about ourselves? When we talk about the Rambam describes, Chayv Adam Liris HaSatzwa Kilehu Yatsa Mitzrayim, that a person's supposed to see themselves as if they left Egypt. They're supposed to tell their children that Kadosh Baruch Hu did this for me when I left Egypt. Are we telling stories of how Kadosh Baruch Hu redeemed us? Are we using that framework, that skill set of seeing the hero's journey, seeing ourselves in the Pesach Seder, in order to tell stories at the Seder that are relevant to us? You know, there's a New York Times article about 10 years ago that Rabbi David Beshefkin likes to cite. It's in his NCSY Haggadah. I highly recommend the NCSY Haggadah. In addition to being amongst those beautiful Haggadahs you're likely to find, it's got one Dvar Torah per page, per section of the Seder, and they're awesome, compelling, and beautiful. And leading up to Maggid, he cites this study that took place in Stanford that the New York Times reported on, that what creates resilience in kids? You know, we're talking a lot about resilience in young children these days as they go through a difficulty. But what creates that resilience? They looked at the stories that they're told growing up. And they put them into three different categories. Category number one, the descending narrative. Things used to be great, and now things are not doing well. Lamashal, you know, life was good, we were happy, but then COVID hit, and now life is just getting worse and worse and worse. We're decreasing. It's very difficult. It's unpleasant for us. Life, Nebuch, just stinks. That's a decreasing narrative. And we can imagine, it's not hard to guess, that children presented with that kind of narrative don't come out so well. They don't come out so resilient. They think the world's out to get them. What's another alternative? An ascending narrative. That a narrative of us, of things going well. Maybe the story that we tell our children at the Seder this year, that we're telling each other at the Seder this year, is, you know, last year was difficult, COVID was very hard, we were all by ourselves, but Baruch Hashem, things are good now, and now things are getting better, things are on the rise. And the ascending narrative, the positive narrative, also actually doesn't leave kids with resilience. The way that to ensure that your children have resilience, the way to ensure that we ourselves have resilience is to go through an oscillating narrative, to appreciate that things were good, and then they were bad, and then they were good again, and then they were bad again, and that we can go through adversity, we can go through challenges and difficulty, and that's not going to stop us, that we'll bounce back from it. It'll be good again, even if we're in the pits, even if we're in the bottom of that trajectory, because we know that we've been at the top before, we know that we'll get back to the top once again. And so the stories that we're telling at the Seder are those stories that are, one, related to the Seder, that are related to Yetzias Mitzrayim, but are there stories about us? There are stories about our family. You know, a few years ago, with this inspiration from Rabbi Beshefkin, I asked my family at the Seder to share stories of how we got here. How did we get to the United States? We know the United States is a melting pot. We know none of our families originated here. So how did we get here? I happen to know that my family is fifth generation American. And so we talked about how did my great-great-grandfather, Chaim Zev, Rabbi Chaim Zev, Baruch Hashem, how did he get here? What was his story like? And that appreciation actually ended up leading me to name our son Chaim Zev after my great-great-grandfather, and as well as my wife's grandfather, and that's why we call him Zevi, because that's the Iker name. Baruch Hashem, they were both Zev and Chaim Zev. But the narrative that we're telling is that a narrative of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of we were going through difficulty and we were redeemed, that we found a way out, that we fit into this hero story that we see so frequently, see so often in books and movies and stories. Because the Sfas explains in Parshat Tetzaveh, Tav Resh Nun Vav, I learned this from Rabbi Brand a couple years ago, that zechira, that memory, is something that lasts eternally. That the Passover Seder, if it's a process of memory, it's a process of appreciating how something that happened in the past is relevant to me, that creates something eternal, that lasts forever. Something that's not in a form of zechira, something that's not in the form of memory, but it's in the form of history, it goes away, it disappears. History can be forgotten, but memories aren't forgotten. Memories build up who we are. If we were to lose all of our memories, we wouldn't be the same person. If we were to get total amnesia, we'd be different people. Not just because we wouldn't know what street to turn on, but because our memories make up who we are. And just like our memories make up who we are as individuals, they also make up who we are as a nation. And so, I think we've elaborated sufficiently that the theme of Pesach Seder, the goal of the Pesach Seder is not history. It's not about an external story that happened to someone else. We don't learn history, like Edmund Burke said, just so that don't repeat it. We don't learn the Passover Seder to beware of a paro who might trick us into servitude one day. Chas v'shalom, that's not what it's about. We learn the Passover Seder, we talk about it, because we see ourselves in it. It's a story about me, it's a story about us. And maybe I didn't literally leave Egypt, but I did leave a Mitzarim. I did leave a narrow street. I did leave, in some way, I left the struggle that I was going through. And for so many of us, just the physical leaving of our homes this Passover is in and of itself a Yetzias Mitzrayim, in and of itself a redemption. But there are so many redemptions that we experience in our lives. And what we want to look for, the Passover Seder, what we want to talk about, the conversation we should be having is not really, if we can be a little bit obnoxious. The conversation we should be having is not the nuanced differences between this, between which was the most wicked of all the children. The conversation that takes place, the fulfillment of the mitzvah, of Yetzias Mitzrayim, is how do I see this relating to me? How like Rabbi Soloveitchik says, the ksav and the mixav, how is this written onto me? How does this relate to me, to our family, to who we are? How does appreciating this story impact the way that I act, impact the way that I look at things? When I'm faced with a para, when I'm faced with a big bad, with that fire-breathing dragon, in the form of my boss, in the form of a bad habit that I have, in the form of people around me. Are we interacting with it? Are we approaching it with the knowledge in mind that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves us from Mitzrayim, that each and every year we are redeemed, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, just like he saved us from Paro, will save us from this, will save us from that boss, will save us from that difficulty in our family? If that's what happens at the Pesach Seder, if at the Pesach Seder we are able to make what happened externally internal, we're able to make it relevant to us, then we'll have accomplished our goal. Then we'll have made Pesach into a geula. Then when we complete the Seder, at the end of the Seder, and we sing Lashon HaBa B'Yerushalayim, it's not going to be just a song. It's not going to be just something we say, but we're going to appreciate that the process of the Seder, the process of what we go through and what we experience, is something that's going to lead me to Yerushalayim. It's going to lead us toward the redemption. And maybe this small redemption won't get me right now into that eventual redemption, but it will get me there. It's one step closer. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to redeem me here, I know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to redeem me here. And so if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to redeem me in this struggle I'm going through right here, right now, in 5781 in Chicago, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also going to redeem me and redeem all of us from the ultimate redemption that we'll see b'mehera b'meinu, God willing, very soon. I look forward to bringing the Karban Pesach with everyone this Shabbos. But if not, have a chag kasher v'sameach. It's been a pleasure learning together. I'm more than happy to try and clarify anything that wasn't made clear. But if not, then have a wonderful, wonderful evening.